Welcome to Inclusion Bites, your sanctuary for bold conversations that spark change. I'm Joanne Lockwood, your guide on this journey of exploration into the heart of inclusion, belonging, and societal transformation. Ever wondered what it truly takes to create a world where everyone not only belongs, but thrives? You're not alone. Join me as we uncover the unseen, challenge the status quo, and share stories that resonate deep within. Ready to dive in? Whether you're sipping your morning coffee or winding down after a long day, let's connect, reflect, and inspire action together. Don't forget, you can be part of the conversation too. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seachangehappen.co.uk to share your insights or to join me on the show. So adjust your earbuds and settle in. It's time to ignite the spark of inclusion with Inclusion Bites. And today is episode 115 with the title From Stigma to Strength. And I have the absolute honour and privilege to welcome Alexandra Parrott. Alexandra works in sales for an HR tech company that introduced the first team-based psychological assessment tool to the talent market. When I asked Alexandra to describe her superpower, she said it is her empathy and fire within to make the world a safer place, one step at a time. Hello, Alexandra. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Joe. Thank you for meeting with me. That was a groovy little song, that. I like that.
Thank you. Yeah, I recorded it a few years ago, and it's I quite enjoy that now. Yeah, because it gets the guest and a bit jiggy before we start, doesn't it? Yeah.
Very soothing voice as well, actually.
Thank you. Yeah. People have often said I've got a bit of a late night radio voice.
Oh, jazz.
Is that your dog joining in the podcast
yes,
as well?
Yes, well, she does like to get involved, to be honest, in any form of conversation I have. She likes to have her say.
And why not? You know, I think the views of dogs are highly rated in terms of mental well-being, care, and we know they can improve people's just whole feeling of well-being, don't they? So yeah,
and she gets happy, why not? So
yeah, maybe she liked the music, maybe she liked the intro, maybe that's what set her off. So we called this episode From Stigma to Strength. Tell me a bit more about yourself and what your passion is.
Thank you. So I suppose there's a few different angles from the stigma to strength, one that's personal and then one that's relevant to the neurodiversity movement, which I am a huge advocate of. So from a personal perspective, I've grown up with a lot of stigma associated with mental health and a specific mental health condition. And I really wanted to use all of that negative energy to create something positive. And as you said earlier, try and make the world a safer place so that individuals that do face a lot of stigma feel a little bit more safe and welcomed and included. And that's why the neurodiversity movement really stood out to me, because I was looking for a community that believed in the concept of turning negative stigma into something positive and seeing the strengths out of something that has had a real negative impact on people's lives. And I was hoping that, you know, someone like me could belong to a community like that. And I didn't know what neurodiversity was or meant or what the umbrella term covered. So rather than just sort of Googling it, I decided to sign up to a degree in it because that's the best way to learn about something and to understand myself and others better. So yeah, I started the degree in January. I think, oh my gosh, that was a while back now.
Yes.
To learn a bit more about neurodiversity.
So you mentioned that you yourself have experienced negative mental health for a lot of your life. Mm-hmm. We find that there's still that, you know, this is from stigma to strength, this episode. There's a lot of stigma around mental health, neurodiversity, anything that people can't see, touch and feel sometimes. You know, people are not aware. And I'm sure you probably experience people saying, well, you don't look like you've got a mental health condition or a mental health challenge. So people are judging you, I guess, from that, are they?
Yeah, I think that's there's a definite strength and weakness that comes with masking and camouflaging, which is a topic that's very, very prominent in the neurodivergent world. And yeah, it can work well in the sense that you really think that you can just get on through and no one's going to see the real me. So they're just going to, we're just going to get through this, to the point where, yeah, you either get, or you don't look like you have XYZ. And I think at the same time, kind of revealing them, taking off the mask, you think that people are going to question your capabilities, because in the world of business, people are often seen as just a number or a revenue generator, you know, a product of performance, and anything that has stigma associated with it comes with that that feeling or thought or that bias that that hinders your capabilities rather than seeing the strength behind. So, yeah.
As the world moved on, yes, you mentioned, I think in the show notes, you were 19 when this was first sort of uncovered and you were able to talk about it. And without giving your age away, that sounds like a few years ago. So do you detect a different attitude in the workplace today?
Depends which workplace you're in, I think. Some are still miles behind. Actually, the founder of the company, sorry, I'm trying to fiddle with a pen subtly and I just threw it across the desk. The founder of the company I work at now was actually the first person that I was open to about my mental health before joining, and in the interview process. Helped that he's a psychologist and has a background in CBT and therapy and things like that. So I just naturally felt confident and comfortable enough to speak to him about it. But I do think that there are still workplaces that are miles behind. And it is not the workplace, it's the individuals that you interact with each day. Each of them will hold their own thoughts and feelings and bias, and can make an entire workplace difficult because of that.
Mm. Does your work impact your mental health, or is it a way of, I don't know, having an outlet to do something different and distract your mind? Because sometimes being busy, having an activity, engaging in something can positively impact your mental health. But having a stressful job or having colleagues or lack of psychological safety can make it a more negative experience. So do you find work is a positive experience generally?
It's an interesting question, because in the neurodiversity world, they often talk about how the environment around an individual can impact that individual. So they could either have a really negative experience. So let's say someone with ADHD or someone with autism or a mental health condition, they could join an environment and have a really positive experience and still have that condition, or they can join an environment and have a really negative experience, but they're still an individual with ADHD and autism. So it's almost like it's not the condition that is causing that, it's the environment around them and the people around them. And I was actually always told with my mental health condition to not have a stressful job. Try and find something that's not too fast-paced, not too stressful. And they certainly would have included sales in that world of fast-paced and stressful and a hinder to my mental health. But again, I think it's less about the job role and more about the environment around you. And that Thomas Armstrong speaks a lot about ideal jobs for that will make an individual with ADHD or autism thrive because of their strengths. So their strengths would make them great at this job. I think there's still a key element of actually the working environment around them is what can impact them, not necessarily the job itself.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, even though I work alone, well, so my wife and I work together, but yeah, we were a micro business. But I'm also involved with the professional association and I chair the board. And I'm very keen from a cultural perspective is that people can bring that whole self to work. I hate that buzzword because...
Oh, I know. People ruined it, haven't they?
What does that mean? Yeah, bring your whole self to work. But I'm very keen that if I'm having a bad week or I'm having a bad day, or I just need to say, stop, I can't. It's too much buzz in my ears, too much noise. Just be able to press the pause button and say, look, Give me a couple of days. I just need to sort this out, sort my life out, get this back on track. I don't want to overload. So having working with people around you where you can just, without having to go into detail, just say, give me five, give me a day, give me 2 days. I'm here. Just give me some space. You don't need to offer to help me. I'm fine. Just need to say, okay, I'm here if you need me. Bye. And it's so when you talk about the environment, the colleagues, the environment, the culture in which you work, it's being able to have those conversations without them being huge conversations all the time, isn't it? Just knowing that that's not another anxiety you've got to cross.
100,000%. My colleague from my previous role, worked for SAP, and my colleague Hannah Oakford, she was the one that actually spoke about making the world, like different corners of the world, a safer place. And she also had a tagline of bringing your worst self to work. Like, we want you to feel like you can bring your worst self to work. And I suppose that is a spin on the authentic self, because there's nothing worse than having, you know, something that's going on, whether there's an actual thing going on or it's just a feeling that you're sat in and you're really trying to force yourself to work and force yourself to play this, you know, play this role or have this mask on. And actually, I've experienced that myself. I lost my mum 2 years ago, and I'd just come back from maternity leave. And I was so stressed. I was like, I've just taken maternity leave and I've just come back. I can't then take off any more time for compassion leave or anything. I wanted to take time off before she passed because I knew it was happening. And actually, the workplace, it was a brand new manager that had taken over whilst I was on mat leave. And he was like, this is just a job at the end of the day. Like, we're just selling software. You take the time to do what you need to do. And I'd never sort of, I hadn't had many managers before that, but just that one sentence that they said to me, I knew that I didn't have to worry, because, you know, that the job was irrelevant at that point. Ideally, as a salesperson, you just come in and you start making revenue, but it was the manager and the working environment around me that made me feel safe. And yeah, that was invaluable at that point in my life, for sure.
Yeah, I completely relate to that. About a year, well, just over a year, probably about 14 months ago, all four of our parents, so Marie's mum and dad, my mum and dad, had a spell in hospital. And at one stage, we had a parent in different wards on different floors of the same hospital, and we were visiting them up and down the lift. And so just if we had both been working for an employer, we both kind of felt that we would have pushed their patience probably to the edge, because at some point you have a job to do, and no matter how flexible an employer can be, they also have to, there has to be some boundary somewhere, doesn't there? And but the ability to just get up and go now when we needed to without having to explain. So it gave us, obviously, We had income challenges. We had to earn a living, yeah, as a freelancer, as a self-employed person. But we weren't constrained by somebody else's rule. And when Marie's mum eventually passed away just over a year ago, she was able to take all the time she needed. And we as a family were able to do that. She could able to support her dad and working through that. And we sat there here one night and just said, that would have been so difficult working for an organisation. Or the organisation that Marie used to work for, especially, because they were, well, I'm not saying they were terrible, but they just weren't very progressive. They weren't maybe, they were kind of a rule-based HR world where this is the rule, this is what you get. Any more than that, it's unpaid, or it's conversations about, are you going back to work? So, yeah, you're right. The environment plays a huge thing, and not having to have that worry is hugely supportive, I think.
And I think as well, like, the experiences that we're covering are experiences that anyone can have, whether they've got a mental health condition or neurodivergent or not. And it's the concept that inclusion really is an individual-led world, because, you know, you can try and be inclusive to people with mental health conditions and to people with neurodivergent conditions, but then there's so many things that can happen in one's life that will completely change the course of their life, and they will need some leeway and breathing space from their employer. And you can't preempt or pre-plan for that. You have to just, you know, work with each individual as an individual, which is the same for the neurodivergent world, to be honest, because I think I can see things happening in the world, but it's still very much focused on a stereotypical profile of what an individual with ADHD looks like, for example. And there's a famous quote, and I can't for the life of me remember who said it, but it's the quote itself has stuck with me, that if you meet one person with autism, you've only met one person with autism. And you can extend that across the neurodiverse space. And I think, again, there's so much focus and energy and effort to be neuroinclusive as a workspace, but they're really just looking at the conditions underneath the neurodiversity umbrella rather than the individuals. And if you take a step back, it's like, okay, yes, it's a different space to learn about, different worlds to learn about. They're still individuals with their own individual experiences and challenges. Not everybody with ADHD needs a fidget spinner, for example, and then they're going to be absolutely fine. It's an individual's journey.
Yeah. Although I sat in on a training session, it was a workshop day with another company once, and they'd put out fidget spinners and tactile play toys, those sort of things, on the tables and things. And I found myself with a fidget spinner. And what I realized by the end of the day is, because I had the fidget spinner and I was playing with it all the time, I didn't pick my phone up. So I kind of learned or realized to myself that my phone had become my fidget spinner. Playing with it, the reclusing into it, the rhythmic, the doom scrolling, whatever it may be. And I found, whilst I didn't appreciate that I needed to have that kind of something in my hand, the fidget spinner worked. And my wife, Marie, she says, I play with my nails a lot and clicking them and sort of, she thought, I'm always fiddling with my nails. She keeps saying, stop playing with me now. I say, well, no, I can't promise not to stop playing with my nails, because it kind of, my brain wants to do it. And, you know, I'm not saying it's stimming or particularly in that sort of zone, but it's definitely, I've got a need to have something going on.
Mm.
I don't know. That's very similar to having some sort of stimulation or something for the brain. When the brain's idle, it needs something to be doing in the background. Otherwise, it just runs away or does something crazy. So, yeah, I completely relate to that.
Busyness and having allowed that. I should really have a fidget spinner, to be honest, because I did. I've learned to fidget below the camera level, so it's not obvious. But I do it with a pen, and the pen flies. So, to be honest, I probably could do with investing in one.
Yeah, and yeah, when I was at growing up, people would sit there and doodle in their notepads, wouldn't they? They'd be drawing, always doodling something, always writing something. When the teacher's talking, what are you doing? I'm just doodling. What are you doodling for? Pay attention. It's like, but that's the same sort of thing, but we just didn't have an appreciation of this need for the brain to have another outlet somehow. And if you look at my desk, it's messy, and I've got these dice, which if you're listening on the podcast, you can't see them, but they're fitness dice, and one's got the number of reps on it, and one's got the exercise you have to do. So if you roll the dice, it says how many crunches you've got to do. Not that I would do, but I often sit and play with these. Well, I've got a couple of Duracell batteries on my desk as well, and I'm often playing with these Duracell batteries.
Yeah.
But it's having that stimulation as a proper toy or something else. And yeah, when you raised that and mentioned it, I completely relate to it.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think there's a lot of ways that we can make the working environment more inclusive to everyone, because the whole working from your desk 9 to 5 in the office 5 days a week, you know, expected to do X, Y, Z. Everybody works in different ways. Everybody's brain needs different things. And that's sort of the main concept of neurodiversity, is to look less at conditions and traits and more at the value in having diverse minds and different minds all operating together, rather than having this concept of norm and this norm environment that everybody must fit in, and if you don't, then you're excluded sort of thing. And I do think working environments are a little bit more flexible than they were, because we're sat at our desks at home fiddling with whatever is on our desk.
I do wonder, you know, we talk about people who have neurodivergency or neurospicy, whatever phrase people say these days. But I often wonder who is neurotypical? Who is that one person on the bell curve of normality that is typical? What does neurotypical mean? I haven't been diagnosed with autism, ADHD. I don't particularly think I've got an extreme case of anything if I have it. But I have traits and go, yeah, I do that. And yeah, I do that. But I wouldn't want to declare myself or identify myself of being neurodivergent. But I often think, well, what is it really? Is it just this broad spectrum where everybody's on it somewhere, and it's just towards the edges you have different needs, and we just have to make sure that we're treating people fairly, because who is typical? Who is normal these days?
Well, I think that's a really good point, because I think outside of the self-advocacy groups of, say, individuals with autism, which are thriving communities that are doing incredible work, and same with ADHD, dyslexia and everything, I feel like neurodiversity is a social movement that is finally battling against the sense of norm. And the more that I do in this degree, the more that I'm like, yeah, actually, what is normal? And where did that even come from? And why do we always have to fit in this box? And Professor Amanda Kirby and Melanie Francis, they have a Do It Solutions organization, and they said, we're all neurodiverse. They make that statement because, yeah, neurodiversity is the concept of us all having different minds, operating in different ways, thinking, feeling, behaving. And that's how, you know, the world thrives. If we were all the same, gosh, well, we'd have a long conversation, would we?
No. And you know, you think about things like Myers-Briggs and those sort of personality testing and disprofile, whether you're a fan of those or not, you know, the concept of introverts, extroverts, all those kind of theories, Carl Jung and all those sort of people. You think about those sort of personality types, and I know you work for a psychological assessment organization, but that really is just realizing that people's brains think differently. And we're trying to work out, this is your type of thinking style. This is your type of personality. What role is going to work best for you? Mm. Where are you going to struggle? And I guess what you're doing in your psychological testing around teams is which styles are going to clash, which styles are going to accelerate each other, group think, challenge, stand out. So it's looking for the dynamics in team to get a balance. So I think neurodivergency is just recognizing what we've been talking all along about, these different personality types and different interests and how we react to the world. And yeah, I fully accept there are people who have, on the ASD, who have more extremes, more complex needs, more support needed. But most people are kind of able to cope with life in whatever way they do once they understand who they are. And I think some of that is just down to self-acknowledgement, isn't it? Where you figure out who you are, what matters to you, what impacts you, how you can support yourself, and then how you can advocate for what I need with others. I think that creating that voice, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, growing up in a world of stigma, you lose that sense of self-advocacy and self-esteem. It's something that we really have to work even harder than others on to build it up. And I've actually heard some amazing stories outside of the workplace of individuals that have more extreme forms on the ASD spectrum, and like children that have a non-verbal and have autism, and they have been placed in an environment that has been adjusted to them, and it's had an incredibly positive impact, to the point where some, not that this would work for all, but some children that are non-verbal with autism have even spoken and said a word when they've been placed in an environment that is sort of adjusted and built around them. But yeah, in terms of the personality tests, it was strange. I was doing reading for my degree in neurodiversity, and it was the first time that my both worlds came together, because there was information about personality tests and the concept of the norm and how this all came about. And the Myers-Briggs personality test in particular, the origins of it were questionable. I really had no idea where they'd all come from. I suppose you don't just sort of sit back and think about that in a day-to-day life. And it was really just testing how safe the organization would be to hire this individual from a kind of mental health perspective. And it did get me thinking about how accessible and inclusive some of the personality test world is. I mean, we go from the Big Five, and I think I've kind of joined the company with a more inclusive, accessible lens of trying to make that talent assessment space a world where you can have like strength profiles and not look at whether an individual's good or bad, or if they're right or wrong, or can or can't perform a job, which is what most competency-based assessments do. But as you said, it's being more strategic in the world of hiring and selection, and looking at the team that you have today and the different kind of personalities and preferences and values and thinking, okay, actually, let's find somebody that's a little bit different in terms of their traits and characteristics and their values to create a more diverse. So you might have a whole team of the same job role, let's say sales, but you're not going to want everybody to have exactly the same approach to that job. And I, when I went through the assessment, I was lower on the scale of emotion control, which actually means I'm more passionate and dynamic than calm and confident and stable approach. And I was very low on outgoing because me, I like cup of tea, puzzle book, bed by 9 p.m., which isn't ideal for the world of sales and networking, unfortunately.
No, but great if you want to be a fantastic mum.
Well, yeah, exactly. It's just necessary, I think. Yeah. I was like that before I had my toddler, but but it was, you know, it wasn't an assessment to say whether I was good or bad at the job. It's just one lens in an overall profile of, well, I just spoke like this to the founder and about my mental health, and he saw something in me.
Yeah, it's if you've got a whole team full of outgoing people who are highly driven and go-getty, you'll end up with a whole alpha crew all kind of compete with each other and conflict and not be supportive. So you need a balance of types.
Absolutely.
Especially when you want people doing a support role or a attention to detail type role, those kind of things. So you do need different personality types, and people tend to gravitate. But even, I mean, I spent most of my life running an IT company. I've been in electronics, and I used to think I had a high attention to detail. And what I discovered was I'd like there to be detail, but I don't want to be the one that does it. So I have got attention to detail in the outcome of others, whereas for me, I actually don't like doing the detail. And that's really, but it took me the best part of 55 years to realize that. When people used to say, well, you've got really high attention to detail. And I've got high attention to spotting when detail is not done.
Yeah.
I'm not the person. I'm an 80% person. I'm a person that is good enough. Let's just go with it. That'll do. We'll figure it out. Whereas, you know, if you're really have a high attention to detail, you're the 99.999% person. And that's not me.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me a long while to figure that out. Now I have. I'm kind of comfortable with that because I go, yay, I get it now. And I just like I've just done now, I share that with people and say, I don't have a high attention to detail myself, but I expect high level of detail in others. And I look out for it. So, I think understanding self is really important as well.
No, absolutely. And I think that's a journey that a lot of individuals have to go on, regardless of, you know, whether they have a neurodivergent condition or anything. And I think a lot of people haven't been on that journey. So whether you're looking at it from the perspective of those that are getting late diagnosis and going on this whole reflective journey of, oh my gosh, this all makes so much sense now, and thinking back on how they've behaved. I think even if you don't have that, before I joined this workplace, I found myself at a complete crossroads where, yes, a lot of very big life events had happened. And I was suddenly What do I want? Who am I? Like, what do I value? And what do I want to do with my life? And all this kind of stuff, which at least 50% of the time, if you're looking for a new role, you might well be in that headspace because your career takes up most of your life. And I'd never really looked inwards in that sense of what can I bring to the table, but what do I also want? And I was actually Googling tests that I could just tell me, like, what's my dream career? Like, what do I want? What do I value? Because I just sat there with an empty notepad, like, I don't know. I've never really thought about this. So before I even came to work where I work, the recruiter I had built up a connection with sent me the assessment because they sort of run through all candidates through it. And I got the report because when I tried to Google it, you take the whole test and then you have to pay for it at the end. And I was like, well, I don't want to do that. So yeah, I just got this report and it just had it all there for me. And I was like, oh my goodness, I've, you know, 31 years and I've never really taken the time to think, what do I want? It's always about do I have the skills? Do I have the experience for this company to want to hire me? And do I have what they want? I've never thought about what do I want? And it's it's quite mad that we never really take the time to reflect on ourselves like that.
Well, here's a question for you.
Oh,
then.
Oh goodness!
So what do you want? What is your? Have you figured that? Yeah, you say. So what did it tell you about yourself that you didn't know before?
I think it kind of gave me my profile of sort of what I bring to the table. I always knew what my weaknesses were and what I couldn't do, but I hadn't ever looked at anything in a positive light. And this is very, very like neutral in the way that it presents traits and scales and characteristics, in that there is no good or bad either end of the scale. And actually the emotion control one was interesting, because I always thought from a mental health perspective that perhaps I don't have the correct way of managing emotions for any kind of fast-paced job, because that's what I was always told. And then I realized, okay, maybe I'm not calm and stable in my approach. I can just sort of like, you know, fluctuate with the stresses of sales. But actually, if you look at that from the terminology of passionate and dynamic, it really starts to give a bit more oomph and give you a strength trait rather than something that I always saw as a weakness as a result of stigma. And that was something that I was never able to do myself. But yeah, looking at the kind of work values as well, like what I kind of wanted from a company, I never really knew. I just kind of looked at the benefits that companies offered.
Money, holiday, healthcare.
Yeah. And then I realized that that stuff actually wasn't that important, because I've had a lot of that before and wasn't necessarily happy within the working environment. Hence why I joined a startup, because I definitely did. You don't join a startup for the benefits, that's for sure. You join it because of the team environment that you're joining and the kind of values that they had and the individuals. So
get shit done, as they say. It's kind of fast paced, isn't it? You're not no huge layers of bureaucracy. It's everybody trying to drive change forward quickly. It's kind of startup mentality, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a completely different world. I've not been in this world, and I was at very big company, like big company mentality before. And I love the fluidity of the startup world. And actually, if anything, if I was advised away from the fast-paced kind of job role and I went for sales, I certainly would have been advised away from the dynamics of the startup world. But I just don't really like to listen to people's advice sometimes.
That's a good thing.
Yeah.
Because I always think we don't listen to ourselves enough. And we need validation. We need someone to say, yes, you can go for that. Is it? That sort of imposter syndrome, limiting belief sometimes. We need permission, don't we?
Yes, absolutely. Like, is this the right thing to do? Hence why I Googled. It doesn't help. I don't recommend that, by the way.
Put it to ChatGPT now, can't
you? Well, yeah, yeah.
Put all your stuff in there and go, what should I do?
Here's a bit on me. What should I do with my life?
Yeah. I'll try that later. See what it says. But I've tried electronics, I've tried IT, and now I'm trying HR, EDI, speaking and training and consulting. So, yeah.
Well, it's something you truly believe in.
Yeah, it is. I often talk about Ikigai, the Japanese art of finding a happy life, which is where you try to find those quadrants where you go, what the world needs, what I'm good at, what I get paid for, but also what truly inspires me. And I always found that I could do three of them. But I never found that thing that truly inspired me, the passion. And now I've got something I'm good at, the world needs, and I've got passion for, and I'm okay at it. So, yeah, but bringing them all together, you find that sweet spot. And I always say that if you find that magic sweet spot in the middle there, work that never feels like work again. You know, I don't need to retire because I'm doing what I love to do.
Yeah.
And it's not. If you blend that in with sufficiency and not gluttony, so we're not looking to have more than we need. If we always work on what we need, the sufficiency, and we don't need bigger, faster, stronger. We just need good enough, what keeps us going, what makes us happy. And if you blend those two together, it really helped my mental health, my stress levels, where I'm not trying to chase something all the time. I'm going, it's okay. I can freewheel downhill for a bit. I'm cool. It doesn't matter. I can take the pressure off. Or, no, I'm out. Don't need to do it. It's immensely empowering as well to be able to have that sort of self-empowerment to say no and stop and I'm off.
Yeah, absolutely. And exactly like being at the crossroads, it feels impossible to find something that fits all of those angles. And taking the degree in neurodiversity was something I never thought I'd do, because I was like, look, I've always wanted to study psychology, but I've got a family now and I need to stick with the job that pays. And how on earth am I going to pay for and fit in a degree and change my career entirely? Because I thought, well, I'm going to have to be a psychologist then. But this just sort of came my way, where it blends the world of psychology, sales, and inclusion and accessibility. I mean, I brought that myself. I was like, I'm only joining if you allow me to join with this lens of how we can make this world more inclusive. And just as you said, where you're sat today, where you're finally combining all of those together. Yeah, that's sort of what happened with me. And not everyone, it's very difficult to get to that place, isn't it? But I think the first step is actually understanding what drives you and what are you passionate about. And yeah, really reflecting on yourself first.
I think I grew up as a Gen X person with that mindset, where you kind of had this expectation of a job for life or a job for long term. It was kind of a career was 10, 20 years type thing. And without casting any judgment on your age, I would suspect you're probably a millennial.
And that, I'm not sure.
Yeah, on the cusp. And there's a very much more transactional work concept these days, where you work is part of your life, not the only part of your life. You're not sucked into it. You want more out of it than just the money. And I think I grew up with that, wanting bigger, faster, stronger, and it's getting off that bandwagon. And I think I'd like to think that in 5 years' time, you have the flexibility in your own head. Say, actually, it's not working for me. Let's try something different. And you will have that empowerment not to feel obliged to stick with what you decided when you left school. And I think that was kind of my parents, when I left school to join the Royal Air Force as electronics engineer. And when that didn't work out after 3 years, they were kind of like, but what are you going to do now? It's like, I don't know, but I'll figure something out. And I kind of fell into IT. So, and I gave that a go for a while, and then I fell out of love with that. And I felt so empowered by not hanging on to something that didn't make me happy. And I think that's what we've got to try and focus on is keep looking at what makes us happy and what fulfills us, what drives us. And then we talk about discretionary effort and going the extra mile and putting our passion to things. That's really where we want to put people, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's interesting that you mentioned that concept of you start a path and you have to stick to that path, and that path, because it starts from sort of school, doesn't it, when you've got to whittle down your subjects and then do some further education in a more specific subject, and then you've got to go down that path that's related to that. And the amount of people that stick to that path is very little, but those that really try without actually wanting to, it has a profound impact on them. And yeah, it's interesting looking at the different generations. The talent world is always trying to do that, looking at Gen Z now and the early career space and the talent that they're bringing in and what's important to them. And I think even less so is it that they have to have a career to get by, and they're questioning the corporate space, they're questioning the corporate jargon and being sold to by businesses. They want to join a business and be part of the conversation. Whereas I suppose before we're very much like, well, this is our space in the business, and we must not go outside of that space or question why we're stuck in that space. Or and the empowerment, the level of empowerment has increased with each generation, I think.
Yeah. So COVID had a huge impact on the world, probably outer space as well, no doubt. But yeah, it had a huge impact on the world, how people perceived the world of work, well-being, and we're now what, 4 odd years past it, and we're starting back, aren't we? I do think we're starting back into kind of can't do it that way anymore. No, can't do it. We're having a COVID amnesia almost.
Yeah. No, I'm noticing that very much so, especially with the actual working environment. Of there was a lot of companies that kind of went down the path of flexibility, flexible working, in terms of where you could work and when and, you know, things like that. And that was positive for the majority of the neurodivergent community in that they could sort of work in an environment that worked for them. And then to be thrust back into, you know, the hiring process where you've got to come on site in person for the interview, putting them in an environment that's going to stress them out incredibly. And then in a workplace, right, well, that's your designated workspace and desk, not thinking about any kind of adjustments. It does seem like we've gone very much backwards, even though we were in that flexible workspace world not long ago. And, you know, it seemed to be working out pretty well. And now companies are trying to reel back that control of putting us all in this box.
Yeah.
And not every individual's brain can work and thrive in that particular environment. So, and it's not inclusive or flexible for a lot of other people either. So, it's been a very interesting conversation, hasn't it, in the workplace?
Yeah, we see a lot in the news from often our politicians driving this. We've become too woke. Yeah, we've got too many snowflakes who want the world to bend over backwards for them. You know, the majority of people just want to get on with stuff and wave our British flag around. And I think I saw it the other day. We're pandering to small minorities. They have to bend over backwards to keep them happy. We've got to stop it. And that seems to be the pervasive kind of political message at the moment, doesn't it?
Yes. I think I developed a twitch in my eye as you spoke about that. I just think that it can be a reflection of the great work that these minority communities are doing to self-advocate, because a response like that means that our kind of work is getting somewhere, and it's irritating those that want that sense of norm and that this is the way that the world should work, because the only reason they would react like that is that we are being heard, not as much as we should be, but I, the royal we. And things are happening and changes are happening and adjustments are being made. I don't even like the word adjustments, to be honest, because adjustments suggest that you're bending over backwards for these minorities, whereas adjustments are very much enablers and should be seen as just standard practice. But yeah, they do seem to be fighting back on the great work that things like the neurodiversity movement are doing. But I think it's a sign of the success that these communities are having, actually.
Yeah, I think if you look back in history where change happens, it's as a result of people really coming together, really starting a movement for change. And then we see the inevitable backlash. We saw it. We still see it around anti-racism in the US and in the UK, a belief that things are better now. Things aren't necessarily better. They're different. But the fundamentals are still there. And I think you look at the LGBT community, there's still stigma around being gay, being a lesbian, being bi, and also almost certainly being trans these days. It's better, but it's still a long way. And I guess when we talk about people with poor mental health, well-being needs, low socioeconomic status, educational challenges, neurodiversity, all those things, again, the typical person is going, well, hang on a minute. What about me? Why don't I get any look in? You know, I've got needs too. I think that's the rise of the incumbent, if you like, the person with privilege saying, I feel my privilege is being eroded. And that's the danger, isn't it? Where it's trying to involve everybody in these conversations and not, I'm a great believer that we can't remove marginalization by marginalizing somebody else. We can't further inclusion by excluding others. It's trying to have these we conversations, as you described it, and moving things forward and shuffling up, taking their space ourselves, recognizing that fairness is around everybody having a bit of a look in. It's a bit like the baggage collection at the airport, isn't it? You know, if you look at the people behaviors, these people will stand right next to the collection belt, staring down the belt, looking for their suitcase. And there's the other people who get off the plane last, who go to the toilet, who wander around, have a drink, talk to their family, and then look over the top and go, oh, my case is here now. Walk straight up, put it on the trolley and walk off. That's me. That's what I do. Yeah. So I'm not pacing, because you don't get out any quicker by standing there waiting. You just stress yourself out. So I think what we need to do is encourage everyone to get off the plane last. Well, no, actually don't. No, because I want to get off the plane last. there's no benefit to rushing on the plane or rushing off the plane. So
it's all human dynamics, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
But I do truly think, you know, you've got two worlds at the moment. You've got the world of talent, where there's a very, very obvious skill shortage in so many areas. And then you've got individuals that are just not being given the opportunities to have the kind of the right education needed, or given any opportunities in the place of work. And they're saying, well how about us? why doesn't the world think about things in a different way and look at widening the talent pool and making some necessary progress to include more people? And then you've got the people in the middle like, well, what about us? It's like, hey, you're already in the world of work. Like, there's so much opportunity for people to be upskilled, reskilled, enter the world of work. But adjustments are necessary, because the world is not built to be inclusive, and it should be.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it's right that if someone says, well, what about me? What about us? Wherever that may be. And by removing social stigma from a lot of things that are stigmatized, flexible working, talk about mental health, parental leave, shared parental leave, both parents involved in bringing up their child on an equal footing, that will allow people to say, well, what about me? To say, well, actually, wouldn't that benefit you as well? And they go, well, yeah, but I don't want it because there's a stigma. Well, what we're trying to do is remove stigma and have conversations about these things, so that you are part of the people who benefit from this as well. You could say, oh, stop, push the button, hang on a minute. I've got to pick my child up from here. I've got to go to the school play, or I've got to, it's my turn to be in charge of shopping and food today, or whatever. I've got to listen to my child read tonight, so I can't stay late. By removing the stigmas, we're actually creating a world where everybody can succeed. And I'm a great believer that I am part of everybody. So if everybody succeeds, that's me as well, because I'm everybody as well. And I think that's what we've got to try and do, is by saying, not just about you and your minority or your particular characteristic or lived experience. We're just trying to make it better for everyone. And you're everyone as well. You're in there.
Absolutely. I don't think our mindset is particularly common, though, because I'm exactly the same. You know, I advocate for worlds that I do not understand the lived experience of those worlds, because I do not identify as that. But I advocate for everyone to have the same opportunities and the same safety. And, you know, I can't see why anyone wouldn't, but I don't really understand how you wouldn't want the world to be a better place for everybody. I know it sounds really lame and cliche, but I think that's, you know, it's not adjustments for minorities. It's opening up the talent world and the world of work and opportunities to anyone and everyone, because everybody deserves a fair chance. And businesses are going to benefit from it. You see these social mobility projects now. Where were they years ago? Why were they not part of the conversation? So something's happening. Something.
Very slow, though, isn't it? It's all very slow.
Slow, isn't it?
The World Economic Forum, they published their gender equity report. They do it every year. And I think the last one is still predicting best part of 80-odd years for gender equity in the Western world. I think if you look at globally, it's 160-odd years. And in certain parts of the world, it's 200-odd plus years. And we can imagine, you know, South Asia, Middle East, there's sort of places, China, Russia, Afghanistan, you know, all these places where we can see gender equity going backwards. And it's, who wants to wait 80 years? I mean, who wants to wait 40 years? Who wants to wait 20 years? Who wants to wait 5 years? And it's the frustration that the pace of change is glacially slow sometimes. And you can only see it by looking backwards to see how far we've come. We're a different world than we were in the 1960s, and we were in the 1950s, and we were in the 1800s. But you look forwards and you think, wow, that dot on the horizon is so small. It's so far away. And we've got to kind of keep the faith that every step forward is a step forward. And the reflection of where we've come from is hugely important. It keeps us motivated, maybe.
Well, I think as well, change, the goalpost's always moving for change, because the goalpost of where we want to be and where we think we should be is always going to change. With the more individuals that speak up about their experience and their stigma and their challenges, you're like, oh yeah, no, we should include that in the conversation. So that the goalpost's always changing, it's always going to feel far away, but as long as you're moving towards it and not backwards, then you're succeeding, you're making an impact, and that's what's important. Absolutely.
Well, we could carry on for another hour, I'm sure. So, Alexandra, tell us a bit about how people can get in touch with you, because it's a fascinating conversation. I'm sure people would love to catch up and find out more about your views of the world.
Yeah. If anyone wants to listen to my views of the world, I've got so many. But I also like listening as well. Yeah, so I am on LinkedIn. I'm Alexa Carter 292. I had to look up my URL earlier because I don't often plug that. But I speak a lot about mental health, inclusion, the assessment world. I work for My People Group, and I'm working on we're a bit of a disruptor in the assessment space, but I'm trying to make us more neuro-inclusive and more accessible. I've done some amazing work with some companies on doing that. And I'm often just, do you know what? I'm not often behind my desk. I'm often working from my sofa. Don't tell anyone. Usually sat next to my dog working on my sofa. I just thought I'd come to my study for the podcast.
Wow. Thanks for your honesty. I mean, I'll let you into a secret as well. Sometimes I deliver training in my pajamas.
Yes. Love that.
But I put a hoodie on.
Yeah.
Even though I wear a hoodie today, I have got dressed. So, and that's the flexibility of working from home. What I wear isn't affecting my ability to deliver anything. It just affects your ability to perceive me as someone who is worth listening to. So, yeah, sofa, office. It's about productivity and output, not how you deliver that.
Still gets the job done, doesn't it?
Does still get the job done. So maybe we'll have another chat in the future around getting the job done no matter where you're sitting.
And no matter what you're wearing as well. Theo Smith was talking about that not long ago. That, you know, what you wear doesn't define you. So I'm all for that. Theo, if you're listening.
Yeah. As a transgender woman, I can relate to that completely. Yeah. What was deemed professional for me 10 years ago is different today. So yeah, it's completely relative to time and space. I often say it's a bit of a TARDIS thing from Doctor Who, where it's all time and relative dimension in space. You know, our sense of self, our identity, who we are, how we perform, is all a TARDIS, and it's all relative.
Well, there's another episode for you.
There is. Alexandra, thank you. As we bring this conversation to a close, I want to express my deepest gratitude to you, our listener, for lending your ear and heart to the cause of inclusion. If today's discussion struck a chord, consider subscribing to Inclusion Bites and become part of our ever-growing community, driving real change. Share this journey with friends, family, and colleagues. Let's amplify the voices that matter. Got thoughts, stories, or a vision to share? I'm all ears. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seachangehappen.co.uk and let's make your voice heard. Until next time, this is Joanne Lockwood, signing off with a promise to return with more enriching narratives that challenge, inspire, and unite us all. Here's to fostering a more inclusive world, one episode at a time. Catch you on the next bite.